Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of KleptoCast, the podcast series from the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. My name is Casey Michelle, and my guest today is Aaron Klein. Aaron is a fellow with the Brookings Institute's Economic Studies and serves as policy director at the Center of Regulations and Markets. Aaron has prior directed the Bipartisan Policy Center's Financial Regulatory Reform Initiative and served at the Treasury Department as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy. Earlier this month, Aaron wrote a piece with American Banker looking at how shell companies, especially those based in the U.S., have hampered U.S. financial institutions' efforts to follow regulations about identifying customers, regulations that are closely entwined with anti-money laundering efforts. So, Aaron, it's great having you with us today. Before diving into just how U.S.-based shell companies throw a wrench into anti-money laundering efforts, could you give us just a quick overview of how these regulations have developed over the past few decades?
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on. Look, when we started an anti-money laundering regime, the modern anti-money laundering regime in America in the 1960s to early 70s, it had two main goals: to crack down on the mafia and to catch tax cheats. Remember, America has a long history of putting organized crime in jail, not necessarily for their crimes, but rather for taxes and movement of money. Remember, Al Capone went to jail for tax fraud. When America started this in the 60s and 70s, it quickly then morphed in the 80s to going after drug laundering and drug money. And then after 9/11, did a U-turn to go after terrorists and terrorist financing. However, it's been an additive process. People have just been layering on more and more regulations and regimes to this process without necessarily refining what it was meant to target. And if you think about it, targeting large organizations that are trying to move ill-gotten cash gains out of America, like drugs and the mob, is very different than trying to track terrorist financing, such as Al-Qaeda.
So turning back to the piece that you recently wrote with American Banker, how is it that U.S. shell companies interact, I guess, on the one hand with U.S. financial institutions, and then more specifically, how do they affect or even undercut these anti-money laundering efforts?
So the core tenet in anti-money laundering is something known as Know Your Customer, or KYC. And it's based on the idea that a bank has an affirmative obligation to know who its customers are, and if those customers are behaving in ways that are illegal or suspicious, that it has an affirmative obligation to report that to law enforcement. So if you think about Know Your Customer, it requires the bank to know their customer. If a customer can get a bank account without telling the bank who they are, how's the bank supposed to know that? You or I can't walk into a bank and say, I want to set up an account, but I'm not going to give you my name.
So when you mentioned, you know, just a moment ago how the anti-money laundering and KYC regimes first developed, it was an additive process, as you said. When it was first developed or in the process of developing, was this simply an oversight as it pertained to U.S. shell corporations and the anonymity provider? Why has this relationship that you laid out, why has it been allowed to develop as it has?
Well, registration requirements are fundamentally state-based, and so the federal government never required – it was kind of two different divisions of law. You had a banking division and a state-based division, and fundamentally, the vast majority of businesses are not set up as anonymous shell corporations, and, you know, there isn't that much of a need, frankly, and so – businesses in the banking industry were forced to adapt. Over time, as this has become clearly a more exploitative process, that's become a bigger and bigger problem. In addition, if you think about it, the goal of the mafia or organized drug cartels was fundamentally, you know, taking large amounts of cash and laundering it through the banking system to move it out of the country. Colombia needed their cocaine money back, right? That's a very, very different thing than trying to get small dollar amounts in through people in terrorist financing. What the banks tried to do was track the cash and follow the money inside. But we're now in a very different world in terms of what our targets are. And the allowing anonymity of corporate ownership allows folks to disguise transactions, real estate ownership, other ways in which people are trying to get large illegal sums of money into the United States. It's very different.
So we're now, I guess, about a year, 12 months later since the Panama Papers release of 2016. Obviously, a pair of American states, Nevada and Wyoming, were mentioned in the Panama Papers release. Aaron, have you gotten any sense one way or the other, at least here in the U.S., whether there's been any kind of renewed push, any renewed momentum for implementing any kind of beneficial ownership registry or making any attempts to identify those individuals or organizations behind U.S.-based shell companies? Is there any momentum that we can point to?
So there is. There's been bipartisan legislation introduced in both the House and the Senate. In the House, it's Congressman Peter King and Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, the leads. In the Senate, it's Senator Chuck Grassley, a chairman of the powerful Judiciary Committee, and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. And this bipartisan legislation has created a renewed push and momentum. Some might be surprised that the Panama Papers, for which the journalist who uncovered it just won a Pulitzer Prize, you know, kind of was a story that in the context of 2016 and the election and other issues kind of didn't get quite the level of attention in the popular press that may have deserved given the substantive revelations. But the political elements of strange bedfellows regarding concern about terrorists and terrorist financing, as well as requiring kind of greater ethics in government and business, seems to be working and slowly building itself forward.
So broadening out just a bit, in addition to U.S.-based shell companies and the anonymity they bring with them, what other problems do the current anti-money laundering regulations face? And just in terms of magnitude, how do these issues compare to those brought by shell companies based in the U.S.?
So the AML issues are very, very large. In fact, you know, people have talked recently about rising regulatory costs and concerns about financial regulatory costs. If your concerns were really driven by the dollars and not by the politics, I think you'd focus a lot more on AML than you would on things like Dodd-Frank. As a matter of fact, these situations have gotten kind of out of control in the sense that I've heard banks estimate $250 to $300 per account they have to spend in compliance with AML regimes. That affects your availability of free checking. It affects whether minimum thresholds. It has a real impact on all of us who are fundamentally users of the system. That means, to put it a different way, we're subsidizing anonymous shell companies' existence because the banks are spending more money on the entire system, which gets divided among all the users. The last point I'll raise about AML is the number of people it targets is quite large. Do you know the most famous person who just had AML charges brought against him over the last 6 weeks?
No, who was it?
The Situation.
From the Jersey Shore guy?
Correct. The Situation has been caught up in money laundering because he was basically taking a bunch of cash he was getting and trying to avoid paying taxes on it and structuring transactions. So that's who's getting caught up in this publicly.
Okay. Well, Aaron, I got to be honest. I didn't think I wasn't expecting the Situation to come up in the conversation today, but I'm glad that he has. I do have one final question for you. This kind of ties back to what we were just talking about momentum here in the U.S. Is there an easy, at least as it pertains to U.S. shell corporations, is there an easy policy fix for this, or what are some steps that need to be taken to begin closing this gap and removing some of the impacts that shell companies have on financial institutions?
Yeah, it's very easy. You should identify yourself when you get a bank account. Who owns the bank account should be known. You know, anonymous ownership of assets is not a good thing for democracy, economy, compliance, etc. You know, when you or I open a bank account, we have to tell the bank who we are. You know, look, when you get into the devil of the details and they're important, how often do you update, corporate ownership changes, family-owned businesses, et cetera, you don't want to create a crazy regulatory burden compliance system whereby every time, you know, one of 10 owners of a business moves, they have to, you know, file an address within 2 weeks or else, you know, they're crazy fines. But there's a clear, simple middle ground of requiring people, companies, when you get bank accounts, to say who owns the company.